The thing about this text, the Vita Merlini, is it's because what Geoffrey of Monmouth did was to take really old traditions, and so he's taking, so you know, this is, if you're thinking about 11th century, he's looking at traditions that have been written down in about the 5th and 6th century. So he's looking way back into the past. What he's doing, what we're doing, right? He's looking at, well, what did the old people how did the old people think, and what did they believe in? And but what he does is he writes. I mean, it's a Latin text, but Latin was the sort of language of people who could read in those days. So he writes something that is actually a kind of bestseller in those terms, you know, because what bestsellers meant that lots of people copied it, the scribes would copy it, it circulated right across Europe. The History of the Kings of Britain and the Life of Merlin goes right across Europe, so it's the equivalent of a sort of Geoffrey Archer novel or something like that today, right? So the people hear about it, get me one of them, please, and of course it's very slow, it could take you 6 months before you get one of them, but it circulates right across the courts of Europe. And it does that because he's taking these old images and ideas, and he's expressing it in terms that made sense to the people of that time. And some of the concerns are the same, and some of them are a bit different from the concerns of today. But of course, so one of the big issues he's addressing in it is the idea of kind of war trauma, how to heal violent time, right? The time he's looking, time of great war. You know, this issue of wars and people killing each other, and how can you live with that is actually kind of quite a big thing. So the beginning of story that says, okay, you begin with trauma, you begin with somebody who can't handle terrible things, maybe can't handle having done terrible things. Now, and he's writing specifically for the Normans, really, who are at that time are powerful, not just in Wales, but and England, just right across Europe. Sicily, dominate France, they kind of, you know, they, and many of these people who, they're no longer, you know, they will have done terrible things, they will certainly have seen terrible things, and they are now in positions of power and security, and of course having to handle the experience of their past or maybe their father's past. And so he writes a book that's about addressing those concerns, but what he does with it, he does something really kind of interesting, because which we'll talk about more this afternoon, where he brings together he really creates the Arthurian myth. Now, the Arthurian myth, Arthur's a big character in Welsh tradition, right? But he's this magical kind of Welsh, kind of rather wild kind of god king somewhere. What Geoffrey does is he creates this image of this figure who brings, and in particular, sorts the Saxons out, because one of the political issues of that time when he's writing in Britain is the fact that the Normans identify themselves with the ancient Britons. They're from, because they come out of Brittany, Normandy, and they're not Saxon. They don't see themselves as Saxons. And one of their political myths when they invade is they are reclaiming the ancient homeland. I mean, it's a lie, of course, there's lots of Viking blood in the Normans, all kinds of things, but it's one of their myths that actually, it's one of their legitimating myths that say, we're not some brutal invaders, we are reclaiming the Celtic heartland from the Saxons. So you get a lot of, in the Merlin stories and in the Arthur stories, you get a lot of the sorting out of this British king who sorts out the Saxons and restores harmony, and restores the ancient harmony. Now, but in the process, he does more than he thinks than he intends to do, because he taps into this very ancient myth of the once and future king. Monmouth. Geoffrey Monmouth taps into the king, or this ancient myth, and which gets attached to the story of Arthur. And so he becomes this sort of a figure that people can identify with. Now, I haven't yet seen the Guy Ritchie film with Arthur. It's getting terrible press. Yeah. But Arthur films always do. And if you're an Arthur purist, there's the my friend John is an Arthur purist. He's lovely, but he has a real vision, his own vision of what Arthur is. He's a great expert. Sir John Matthews, great expert on the stories. And John, I mean, John almost certainly will go to see the film. He can't bear not to go and see Arthur films, and he always comes away pissed off and angry and sort of, and he'll rave on Facebook about it for a bit probably, because that's what he normally does. And it's partly because he's got such a clear purist image from his own reading, and I always think him, and I've had this conversation with him, I think, look, John, you miss this. Actually, what's interesting is the way this myth gets reinterpreted. Now, we're living in brutal, powerful, difficult times, so this film probably is going to be quite brutal. And it'd be interesting to see that, because how does the myth intersect? So that's the other thing about myth, as well as it gives us access to older ways of thought, it gives us access to collective understanding. So what we can see from the Geoffrey Monmouth kind of story gives us a real insight both into some different ways of processing life, and an insight into what was the collective doing at that time. But you can easily get lost in myths, and that's the problem is if you, cause, and there's a sort of romanticism around it, which is, well, I want the pure myth, or I want to live in that nice time. And that's always the danger of myth, where you fantasize that there's some kind of perfect time which would be better than now, that doesn't have Trump in it, or doesn't have Theresa May or whatever else is going on that's disturbing us. Whereas actually the whole point of this particular story is the necessity of disturbance, the necessity of opposites, necessity of struggle. The particularly interesting thing about the Merlin story, as opposed to some of the Arthur stories, which get a bit more Christianized, is there's no invocation of Christianity in it. We're not talking this afternoon about the vision of creation you get in the Vita Merlini, and the vision of the universe you get in the prophecies of Merlin, are absolutely pagan. They relate back to female god figures. So it's the goddess Minerva. The goddess Minerva inspires Taliesin to show Merlin the vision of the universe in the Vita Merlini. In the journey of the prophecies, he goes deep into the land. He doesn't find Christ in the land. He doesn't find the saints. He finds a woman who is holding the forest in one hand and the city in the other hand. He goes into the stars. He finds the goddess Ariadne, the weaver goddess. So there's something, I mean, Geoffrey is doing something quite remarkable there, but because it's fiction and because it's a good story, it just doesn't get picked up on, that he's actually preserving very ancient traditions around the divine feminine, not disguised as Mary, not disguised as Christian, they're just there. And one of the things that we know generally is that the weaver goddess is one of the most ancient of the goddess creator. She's the goddess who creates the universe. There's in a lot of very old traditions, and God help us, suddenly we find that sitting there in this medieval book. Now and in a way he kind of gets away with it, because it's a sort of because it's regarded as a kind of bestseller story, but he puts all kinds of little clues and riddles in there which are kind of teaching poems or devices that get you to do that, if you know can teach you various kind of meditations or practices that kind of that you can just kind of pass over. Prophecies of Merlin, which is part of the meditation we did just before the break, is actually a journey into the body, into chaos, into destructiveness, into everything breaking down, into going down into the land, into the great pool of collective life. You know, so you begin, if you like, with a situation where you've got this tyrannical king who wants to murder the magical child. Now, from one way of understanding this is that there's a part of us that is the tyrannical king that always wants to murder the child, always wants to murder the part of us that can't be pinned down, and wants to build our bloody tower. You know, this begins, you know, this story begins even in a very disturbed place, right, where your tower is shaking, your tower keeps falling down, in fact, the tower. And so you consult your magicians, and your magicians say to you, what you need is the blood of a child who hasn't got a fatherless child. Stick that on the foundations, it will all be well. So it sort of suggests, well, the way to really establish your dynasty and your tower is to commit murder, the murder of innocence. And hell, there's plenty of that going on at the moment in the world. But what the story says, and the subversive aspect of our story says, well, that isn't going to work. And Merlin, the boy Merlin, who really represents that part of us that is wild and can see through things, says, well, no, you've got to look into the nature of things. And if you go underneath the tower, you find this pool. What if the pool, in a way, is an image for the pool of collective archetypal life? So you go into the pool, but if you go even deeper than the pool, you find these two great energy, you find these hatching eggs that are the vibration of which is disturbing the tower. And what happens is they come out, these energies, the red dragon and the white dragon, and are they peaceful? No, they're not. They fight. They wrap around each other. There's this energy of opposites that is challenging, bouncing off against each other. And then you get this huge kind of vision of everything breaking down, you know, and this sort of, you know, and in the vision, everything's going to hell. One thing goes wrong, the Roman baths become poisoned, and monasteries fall down, churches fall down. And you come to this, what happens is you then get this fountain coming out in the middle of the land, and it's got three streams, this fountain. If you drink one of them, you die immediately. Another of them gives you eternal life, and there's a third stream that just keeps transforming everything, exhausted. And if you drink of that one, you'll be hungry all the time, and you'll never be filled. But nobody knows which is which, and. So he has to go deeper again, and then he finds this goddess who dries up the noxious spring and just leaves you with the spring of life that will enrich your life. So you've got to go to a goddess for that. If you follow the goddess, she walks through the land bringing the dead to life. And then there's a jump again, where suddenly you find yourself out in the star, out among the planets, and the moon goes wrong. The moon starts to come out of its orbit, and then the other planets come out of their orbit. So everything starts to break down again. And then, as everything starts to break down, you find yourself encountering this figure with two faces, the Janus god, who is the threshold god, who stands between the worlds, who looks both ways, who takes you into the mist, and then you get given this vision of the goddess, of the weaver goddess Ariadne. You can't really see her, she's in the mist, so you have some mysterious encounter. But then it just ends with the winds coming together with a great clap. So everything, boom, implodes. So it's a catalytic, explosive kind of vision of everything vanishing into something, and you don't know where, that's where it ends.
You could, in answer to the foolish question, say, well, people come to me when they're stuck with things and they want me to sort something out. And my job is to subvert all the taken for granted things that they've done before that haven't got them anywhere.
Yep.
And they look to me for radical solutions
that
nobody's ever thought of, that people might think are ridiculous, but equally well could work.
Yeah.
So that's why I read these old myths.
Yeah.
Because they are good workaday examples of shifting things.
Yeah, totally.
Shape-shifting.
Yeah, great way of saying that. Yeah, good. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And you said shape-shifting yesterday, didn't you?
Yeah. Morgan's a shapeshifter, but so is Merlin. Merlin is also a shapeshifter, the later legend. He keeps transforming.
They're all shapeshifters.
Well, they are. That's right. Yeah.
The traumatized warrior is shape-shifted radically yesterday. Mm. Back and forth. He couldn't decide. Couldn't settle.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of rushed headlong into this and that. And he transformed as you listened to it.
Yeah. Mm. And so does she.
Mm. Yeah.
Because I just looked at the last paragraph.
Yeah.
Thinking, I'm really unsatisfied with this. I'm going to look at the last paragraph. And she says no to the Norman. Mm-hmm. And that's that whole thing of her brother recognising something.
That's right.
A little bit more. Mm. She disintegrates more. There is something in that. But she shapeshifts too.
Yeah, she does, yeah. Yeah, absolutely she does, yeah. Well, yeah, she massively shapeshifts. You see, she begins as the queen of a, and she ends up as this kind of, also this kind of wild figure in the forest who's connected to the deeper
layer. So Becky's clients will shapeshift as a result of her reading these notes.
Okay,
Becky.
And they do. Yeah. I think that's interesting, isn't it?
No, I think that is
part of the transformative.
Yeah.
I always find that when I'm put on the spot, in the kind of like, so what do you do?
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I find like, and I think probably because I'm not very good at remembering. Like, if you ask me about this story tomorrow, I won't necessarily remember it.
Yeah. But it's not.
And I don't grasp things like that very well. So I find I've got to keep going in and out.
But that's the process, you see. You keep going in and out. Because actually, the point is, the point of this is not to remember the myths. No, but that's not the point of it.
They don't sit with me.
No, it doesn't matter. That's not the point of it. It's a bit like Merlin going back and forth between the two worlds. The point of it is to go back between those worlds. And the key for every one of us, really, is about what do we take from this? Right? So it's what the experience of doing this does. You know, it's not about remembering them. You know, if I think of some people who are brilliant, much better at remembering myths than I am. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's not what we're doing here, because you can become like an expert on myth, but there's nothing wrong with that, nothing wrong with being an expert on anything, is there? But what we're doing is something different from that. We're not doing it to become an expert on myth. You know, I'd be teaching you completely different if I wanted to teach you to be an expert on Welsh myth. We'd be doing it in a much more orderly kind of way. Instead, I bung in these stories fairly, you know, not quite randomly, and then we see what happens when we struggle with these images.
But it's also that kind of, you know, if we look at all, you know, some of the great therapists that quite a lot of us here have sort of trained in, they're all completely messed up, all of them in their own way.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's not like they had this great story that we need to somehow integrate into our world, is it?
No, totally.
And kind of what I like about this is it's not a happy ending.
No, totally.
I kind of like the destruction of it all.
Yeah, definitely.
It sits really well with me.
Yeah, exactly.
If there was a happy ending, I'd be quite disappointed.
No, I agree.
I quite like that. I like that destruction of it all.
Yeah.
And the breaking apart of it. But what I'm noticing is as I'm now moving more and more between these kind of worlds, I do at least want my bridge to be solid.
Yeah.
And it's making me question what it might be made up of.
Yeah. So what is it made up of then? So
well, my sense is the land either side is definitely not solid.
Mm.
So if I'm going to be bridging these spaces, then how do I know what the bridge is in any way got any solidity in there? Or is that in itself constantly shape-shifting?
Yeah.
Because if that's the case, then I've got to question the fundamentals, not just of who I am, but is any of this of any use?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like I'm back sitting in a monastery going, well, who am I? You know, mm-hmm. and I get that, and I get the importance of that, but I've also got to get on. You know, I kind of feel like I want to...
Yeah.
There's such a lot happening.
Yeah.
If anything, I actually need to find solidity.
Yes, absolutely. At some place. Nothing wrong with solidity.
The place of a good heart.
I think that is for you.
For you, no, but Becky needs her own solidity. That's for you, definitely. No, not universal. There's no universal answers here. The answers are always... The answers are always specific.
It's your good heart, isn't it?
Yeah.
Possible that the bridge could be the foolish question, which may be a daft thing to say, but Merlin was continually asking why.
Yeah, that's right.
Obvious, why does the sun go across the sky? Well, it's obvious. Yeah. But he continually asked the foolish question.
Yes, that's right.
And that was his skill.
Yeah.
That may be your skill, that may be your bridge. asking the foolish question is better than listening to the wise answer, because the wise answer is solid and formed. The foolish question shifts things.
Yeah, and he never gets answered, if you look in the story, right? So there isn't something, or at least the answer he does get given in the end is the whole universe. Like, the whole universe, why? Well, it's like, you get something similar in the Bible, actually. You get Job asking, why do bad things happen? So in the book of Job, and the God's answer to him is to show him the whole universe. You know, so it's kind of an answer, but it takes him beyond the question. So, but the question is crucial, because the question brings about the whatever the response is, and the response isn't linear. The response is peculiar, is in peculiar things happening. It might be in pigeons crashing into windows. It might be in feeling disturbed by something. It might be in something very simple and ordinary, a good idea, you know. But it doesn't come straightforwardly.
But there's something else that is solid and bedrock, and this has come out of that. And because I'm kind of looking at the tree, and that's like the outside line, and these are the inside lines, and that is the one thing that we don't really think of, but it is solid, is that you can feel your breathing, and that will, you know, we just don't think of it because we take it for granted that you could always, you know. You can lose your sight, you can lose your hearing, and even lose your marbles like that, but you can feel your breathing like that. So that is a kind of, and that's within the cage, that's the city, and then the outside is the forest, but that's the cage of the city, is the heart. But your heart is, you just, it's still a bit sort of tennis, because you can't actually feel, you just can always, you know, fall back on, you can feel your lungs breathing, and it's a benchmark and something you can lean back on, and then go out and think of questions about the universe and myth, that, you know, like, fall back and I can feel my breathing. I've been able to do that till the last breath.
Yeah. Of course, another answer to myth, why do we look at myths, is because they put you in touch with spirits. They put you in touch with spirits.
Who does?
A myth does, a story does.
Okay.
So if we tell the story of Merlin, or if we contemplate the story of Merlin, we bring Merlin into the room.
And that addresses that thing, that divide you talked about earlier, that way of thinking that came 17th, 18th century, where spirit kind of disappeared.
Yeah, totally.
Bring the spirit back. Yeah. Challenges the taken for granted. Mm. Denial of spirit kind of works around all the time.
Yeah, it totally does. I mean, that is one of, you know, that was one of the massive things that happened. Because up until the 18th century, I mean, obviously, a lot of the belief systems are, of course, very Christian at this point, but there's still a lot of belief in an experience, not just belief, but experience of spirits, ghosts, elves, living, you know, the living world. But what you see happening then from the 18th century on is the narrowing down of that world. You know, that's why you get Descartes, say, you know, who decides that being is to do with thinking. I think, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. So thinking becomes kind of it, so it's like narrowed down in a sense. So the world, instead of being experienced as a living, flowing world, includes the whole body. It's no, I think, I am because I think. And in a way, that's the kind of reductionism then that of course 19th century science gets based upon. The thing about 19th century science is it's pretty good science. It works. You know, actually the thing about that, even narrowing down, I think I'm going to be logical, I'm going to work things out in this way. You know, that's, you can say, oh, that's a terrible thing that's happened in human life. Well, certainly there are some costs about it. But actually, it's that way of being that creates electricity, that creates steam technology, that create, you know, certainly creates new needs. But, and so there's a whole thing that starts to come into being. That of course is very, very successful. But because it's so successful, and because it comes together with colonialism, because it's the you know, Western European powers that really get this, particularly Britain, you know, which is the, then you have the sort of technologically minded, technologically advanced world colonizing the rest of the world. Now, wherever they meet the imaginal in that world, that becomes the province of the heathen savages, the un-Christian savages, who have to be brought into the light, not just of Christ, but the light of the rationalist enlightenment. That's right. But that encounter intensifies that belief, right? That the rationalist, that the Enlightenment view, is right, because you're more powerful. You beat the heathen savage tribes because they don't have your technology. They don't have your military technology, principally. You know, that's kind of guns. You know, as well, Britain in particular is one of the great gun makers of the world, And so that intensifies that belief that all this stuff is heathen, savage stuff, and you get things like, and you know, nearer to home, in Wales and Ireland, they want people not to speak the heathen languages of Gaelic and Welsh and you want people to come away from the countryside because you need them in the factories, because you need massive demand for people to get into the factories and build up. You also want to get people off your land because you want to create these new 18th century estates. So you know, so you get where you need to dispossess the rural poor. So there's a whole set of socio-political factors that come into play here. But in our subject, that really intensifies the idea that anything to do with the imagination is futile, and so anything, you know, the other reason for studying myths is because they help us develop our imaginal senses and abilities, and that runs counter to that whole idea in the world that says well, all this is heathen rubbish that will lead you into unchristian ways, or if not that, it'll lead you into useless ways that are not productive. And you get that whole, you know, if you think of that whole kind of Samuel Smiles thing you get in the sort of late 19th century where people are encouraged to emulate the great Victorian kind of entrepreneurs. Great hero of Margaret Thatcher, Samuel Smiles. He wrote this book of which actually in a way was his own imaginal book in a way of hero stories of Victorian entrepreneurs, and they're always good people who have an idea and who then build up this tremendous kind of industry. And that's, if you like, the imaginal world of Victorian Britain, the kind of the world of the patriarchs, saying, you know, leave all this heathen stuff behind, go to work. And it really means go to work in my factory, but go to work and then you will be a productive, useful citizen of the new world, really.
We lost a great king in Wales last week with Roger Morgan.
Yeah.
Ah, yes, yes.
I photographed him on several occasions.
Yeah,
he's
amazing guy.
Really lovely, kind man, yeah. Highly intelligent. And I had to go and pick him up. One time I had to go and photograph him down in the bay, and when I was working for the Independent, and he was at the Transport and General Workers Union buildings. And no other MP or man of his status would do that, but I picked him up in the car. He said, "Oh, well, pick me up and I'll take me down and drop you back," you know. He's that kind of, he's a real man, he could talk to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
He was always down at Cardiff Market after he retired.
Mm.
And he'd always come up and say hello, and he did it to everyone, not just to me.
Mm.
He did it to lots of people. He was really, had his caravan down in West Wales. And he got really lampooned when he was going for the, when Roderick Morgan got put in as First Minister.
Aye.
And he was asked by a Paxman, are you going to go for the First Ministership? And he says,
there's
a one-legged duck spoon circles. Because he gave a metaphor which he got completely blasted.
I know, it was wonderful.
But actually, he came from a really rich place. He really was a bridge, actually.
That's true. Yeah.
All the people I've photographed, lots of people, and not many people actually feel really sorry to hear they've gone.
I can hear it, actually. Yeah, that's nice.
Anyway, I just wanted to.
Yeah, that's lovely. Yeah.
I guess the other great thing about him was that he doesn't seem to have accomplished
great things in an obvious sense. Actually, you know, he made a lot of changes in the NHS and broke with policy from England and from the government. So there are lots of, you know, free museums and things, so he broke...
Free prescriptions,
lots of stuff like that. So he did a lot of power, actually, good things in a very quiet, sort of understated way.
That's nice of you. Good. So, thank you. And are you trying to get in as well, girl?
Yes, I was going to say, we're at a turning of a wheel. I don't know if that's quite appropriate, but we're getting into robots now.
Mm.
We're getting into not going to the factories.
Absolutely.
It's like a whole new...
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about the myths in that.
Yeah.
That new paradigm, is that the word? A new way of, like,
we'll come back to this afternoon, actually, because we need to go for a lunch now. But that's an important thing you've just raised. There's a great novel called American Gods by Neil Gaiman, who talks about the new gods that are arising, the new myths that are telling themselves, and what happens to the old gods in that process. And in his depiction, which is a bit chillingly prescient. I don't know when was that book written. Is it? Because it's written long before Trump. Is it 2001. And he envisages in this book the fate of the old gods that are in America, where these new gods of the kind of the shopping mall or the gods of technology arising, and the kind of and in a way he's looking at then differences in the archetypal landscape that's arising because of human belief and devotion to the new gods. Now Trump, in a way, is a character, is a figure out of the new gods. Right, he absolutely, because there's no doubt that man carries a huge archetypal presence, right? But it's a different presence. It's really kind of different. It's got elements of the trickster in it. But it's a different kind of archetype. It's a sort of, he's like, I don't know what god we would give to him really, but it's a god of he arises out of the mythic landscape of celebrity television.
Oh God, what have we done? Oh God.
It's definitely that, but that's part of the way the kind of, and then the other reason for studying myths is to understand archetypal collective structures and shifts. And we're going to be, in the second year of the course, we're going to be concentrating almost exclusively on that, because we're looking in a way in this period of really developing our own capacities to work with the mythic and that collective field. And then it's okay, what do you encounter when you do that? And the Merlin myth is one of these crossover myths, because we're dealing very, very much with the individual and the collective in this story. So another answer to Becky's question really as to why to study this is to be with our own imaginal relationship to ourself and our world, and to be able to work with collective energies and personal energies in this way. And in a way, when we talk about the zeitgeist, the energies of the time, you know, that's the sort of, that's the kind of area that we're looking at. Well, what are the energies arising out of the collective? And to look at that, and that's why it's really important to look at popular culture. The thing about what happens with myths sometimes is people get fascinated by the world of myth and very dismissive of popular culture. But actually, it's in popular culture you see the old archetypes replaying themselves in new kind of ways. And so we'll look a lot of that. Anyway, time for lunch.